Okay, we'll start. We're on the fourth Mishnah in the third Perek. Reb Shimon Omer Shlosha She'ochlu Al Shulchan Echad V'lo Omru Al Av Divrei Torah Ki Ilu Ochlu Mizivchei Mesim She'ne'emar Ki Kol Shulchanos Malu Ki Tzoa B'li Makom. Okay, so we already explained the Abarbanel's commentary to this Mishnah, and today we're going to other commentaries. The Medrash Shmuel points out, it doesn't say Shlosha She'ochlim Al Shulchan Echad, three people who are currently eating, but three people who ate already, which intimates the following halacha, that Ein Masichim Besuda, not supposed to talk while you eat, because we're afraid that you may choke. And if you're talking while you're eating, the food may go down the wrong pipe. So therefore, after they finished actually eating, now they say Divrei Torah. But not while they're chewing and swallowing, you don't say Divrei Torah. Anyway, my mother told me you don't talk with your food in your mouth, so this mission is unnecessary. Okay. Right. Okay, also, one of the commentaries points out, again, the Medrash Shmuel, that Gimel She'ochlu means they happen to have eaten together, which seems to imply that it's not a good thing to eat together with other people. Yet, one of the other, what's it called, commentaries says that there's a dafka, the more people eating together, the more there's a responsibility to mention the Rabbanu Shel Olam and to give praise to him, because the more people together, the more praise there is for the Rabbanu Shel Olam. We have a klal, Barov Am Hadras Melech. The more people, the more honor to Hashem. So they seem to be contradictory. I was thinking that perhaps there's no contradiction. If a person, Stam, is having lunch, there's no inyan to invite other people to eat together with him. They're eating for your own personal welfare. It's a private thing. On the other hand, if you're having a special suda in which to eat, to commemorate a mitzvah, to commemorate some kind of thing that you're thanking the Rabbanu Shalom for, there the more people, the better. Because there, the more people that are involved, the more covet is going to come to the Rabbanu Shalom. But if you're just eating your regular meal, right, and then you're going to just say Divrei Torah there, better to eat, it's a private thing, just that kind of eating. So it could be that they're talking about two different kinds of meals. Also, why three? Because when three people eat together, they're considered one unit. Then they have to bench mezuzah. Used to be, we don't do that today. It's not just that the person would say Rabosai Nevoreich and the other people would answer and then everybody would bench themselves. But the person who invited everybody to bench would bench the benching out loud and everybody else would listen. And that's where they were benching mamish together. It's still proper, it says, for the person who's benching the mezuman, the mezamein, to bench out loud, and everybody, however, says word for word with him, low. And then it's still considered one group. We don't do that for the most part either, right? Unless you're an NCSY and they bench, you know, everybody together, out loud, or in camp,
Right? They pay money.
Yes, because that's they keep really what's traditional. Pay money. But the reason we don't do it is because people's minds wander, and to be yotze such a long benching and get every word is unusual. And even if you bench together with the person benching, also you can't keep up the pace. People like to keep their own pace, so either he's going too fast or he's going too slow. So our minig is the person who benches, who invites everybody, says those first things. The most proper thing is that the first bracha he says out loud, and that one people say low with him. One bracha, you can do that. Till hazonis hakol, and then everybody benches for themselves at their at their pace. That's usually what is done. The idea of a Birkas HaZimun, and then they're benching as a unit, so each one is not considered an individual to himself, but rather the unit, the group themselves are considered a group. So you can say something about the group. Three people who ate together, right? As if they ate from God's table, or they ate from, and didn't say Divrei Torah. We're not faulting individuals, we're faulting the group as a group. Okay. So that's why it mentions three. Now this idea of eating and saying Divrei Torah is because through eating a person can come to greater Hakoras Hashem and Avodas Hashem, because eating, if you eat with the right intention, is to get strength to serve Hashem. And also you have Hakoras HaTov. You have gratitude for the fact that you have what to eat, and that you're able to continue and support and promote your life by eating. Or you can eat and descend down to be like an animal. Animals also eat. And your whole intention should just be to fill your stomach, so then you're like an animal. So eating can either elevate you and elevate the food, and in that respect, it's even more than that. The way that we elevate things to God partially is by eating. In other words, every strata of existence, and there are four. There's the mineral, vegetable, animal, human being, and the Kuzri says that Klal Yisrael is a higher level of human being. So what we do is the following. The mineral is elevated by going into the vegetable. Vegetables, in other words, the vegetation exists on minerals mainly in the soil. So the mineral world, which is the lowest, is elevated and goes into the plant. Plants are eaten by animals, so they're ingested in the animal and raised in that respect to the animal level. And animals are eaten by human beings, and they raise the animal to the human level. And human beings serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So we, by eating, one way we raise the whole world up, and then it becomes part of us, and our service to Hashem includes mineral, vegetable, animal. On the other hand, the Gemara says that a Am Haaretz shouldn't eat too much meat, lest it's a mitzvah to eat or whatever. Because why? Because the meat can be raised to the level of the human, or the meat can drag you down to the level of the animal. So a person who is of a higher, more noble level, so he'll raise the meat higher. Person who's on a much lower level is going to be dragged down by the meat. So unless he's eating Shabbos, Yontif, right, eating for a mitzvah, right, better he shouldn't eat that much meat, because there's a chance that he'll be dragged down to the animal instead of dragging the animal up to him. Just as a little bit of a parenthesis over here, eating meat before the flood, they weren't allowed to, it's not a question whether they were allowed to eat meat or not, but they weren't allowed to kill animals to eat meat. If the animal died, there is an opinion they could eat meat. But some held that they couldn't eat meat at all. Some learned that, therefore, the ideal is to be vegetarian. Right? But the Torah permitted eating meat and made it a chiyuv to eat meat on Yontif, Shabbos. Right? So somebody who doesn't eat meat ideologically is basically an apikoros. Torah said the Rabbanu Shem who created these animals said you can eat them. You think that you're better than God. God doesn't know what he's talking about. He said you can eat the animals. He made them. And we think, no, it's not right to eat animals or whatever. Okay. So ideal. But somebody who says, look, like I said, I don't know if I can handle eating meat. Maybe it's going to drag me down to be too hedonistic and animalistic. Or he says that eating meat maybe is not as healthy as eating, being a vegetarian. And I'm doing it for health reasons. There's nothing wrong with that. Somebody who wants to be a vegetarian for health reasons, or because he's afraid that he can't handle the meat because it'll drag him down to be more like the animal. And some say that some of the laws of kashrus are dependent on that. The animals we don't eat are animals that are animals of prey, that have cruelty in them. And you are what you eat, right? Not necessarily that... there was a poem that I remember from high school, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
Oh, yes.
Where the person was a cannibal, they had a, and he was all the other people that he ate. It's not exactly what we're talking about. Even though I saw once an experiment they made, they took three groups of worms, and they taught one group to react to a stimuli, light or something, that whenever they shined the light, they knew they would get food. So they knew when the light went on, they turned a certain way to get their food. And they taught this group of worms that stimuli. And then they killed them and ground them up and fed them to other worms. And they had a control group of worms that didn't eat the worms that were trained to this stimuli. And then they tried to teach that same stimuli to these two groups, one that ate the ones that were taught the stimuli and the one that didn't. And they found that the worms that were ate the ones that were taught the stimuli learned that stimuli much faster than the other ones.
Wow.
So what you eat has an effect on, right? The... It doesn't necessarily mean if you eat Einstein, you'll be Einstein, but in any case, it's the midos ros of animals sometimes goes through the fact that you embody that animal within you. The bad qualities sometimes come through it. So therefore, a person who says, look, I can't handle meat, I don't like it, or whatever, right? The Torah said it's okay. So I'm not ideologically becoming what's wrong to kill animals or whatever. The Torah said it's okay. In fact, the reason it was wrong before the flood is because God created animals, He created human beings, and why should a human being have the right to kill an animal for his food? He could live on grain or whatever. But after the flood, the animals owed their existence to human beings. Noah kept them alive for a whole year in the Teva. So now man had a right to kill animals and to eat them. Another reason is, before the flood, the world was not tilted on its axis, so says the Sfarno. That happened because of the flood. And therefore, where people live, which was pretty much by the equator, the seasons were, there were no seasons. It was always an even season year-round, and therefore the nutrients that were produced in grain and fruit were on the highest, most ideal situation, and they could preserve a person's health, just fruit and grains. The Mabul made the world crooked, and now there were seasons. So the fruit and vegetables could not, grow in the most ideal way, and they weren't able to produce the nutrients that a person needed to be able to survive. So you had to supplement the fruits and vegetables and grain with protein from animals. That was a result of the flood. I have a different idea, which explains the whole concept of the flood a little bit and why after the flood they ate meat and before not. And it fits with what we're talking about. So I'll mention it. The question is raised, I understand if people were corrupt and evil, that they had to be destroyed as a punishment. But why did God destroy the animals? Animals don't have free choice. They weren't evil. So if they were corrupt, it wasn't because they were bad, right? So why did they have to be destroyed? It's not only animals. Maybe you could say, well, animals have some intelligence. Maybe they knew what they were doing. But the trees were destroyed. Not only that, the topsoil was destroyed. Well, topsoil was evil. It had some kind of free choice. It doesn't exist. So why was it destroyed? In addition, after the flood, God took an oath that he would not destroy the world again with a flood. Any kind of flood. The world's not going to be destroyed again. And he made the rainbow the simon, the os, the sign for that oath. Two problems. First of all, if the world would reach a level where it had to be destroyed again, then why couldn't God destroy it? And if he could forego destroying it the second time, why didn't he forego destroying it the first time? Why did he destroy the world the first time if he could not destroy it if it deserves to be destroyed? And if the world is not going to deserve to be destroyed, why did he need an oath not to destroy it? Why should he destroy a world that doesn't deserve to be destroyed? So either way, it doesn't make sense. God's oath not to destroy the world, if the world's not going to be fit to be destroyed, why do you need an oath? And if it is fit, then why would God not destroy it like he did the first time? And if he could do it not the second time's even worse, didn't learn the lesson, then why couldn't he forego destroying it the first time? So therefore, what many of the commentaries say, and I'm going to use to explain the other details here, is the following. Before the flood, people were given tremendous influence over creation for a good purpose, because man was supposed to rule over creation and perfect it and bring it up in service of God and have a good effect on everything and raise its level to be to sanctify it and to make it more holy in service of God. So people were supposed to influence the world and bring it up to a higher level of using it for service of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Because of that, God had a tremendous influence that he showered on people that they then showered on the world. That influence of raising the level of the world. However, every power that's given in the world can be used for the good and equally for the bad, otherwise there's no free choice. And that's the concept of Ze le'uma ze osu Elokim. The Ribbono Shel Olam made everything in balance, good and evil. Any power for the good can be equally used for the bad. Atomic power can light up a city, right? Electricity, whatever, right? Cure illnesses, can destroy also. As good as it can be, that's how bad it can be. So instead of using that power of influence to elevate the world, the people's influence was, it corrupted the world. What people do affects the environment around them. And just like people can pollute the world, right, the animals, the air, the soil, in a physical way, they can pollute it in a spiritual way. Before the flood, their actions caused spiritual pollution that corrupted everything around. It even corrupted and polluted the topsoil, surely the animals. So when people became corrupt and they began to be immoral, it corrupted the animals, and the animals started living and having relations with animals that were not their kind. But it all came from the influence that people had. And it was like a pollution, a spiritual pollution, corruption of the world. Even today, they say that there could be a connection like that. I saw an article years ago that the pigeons in San Francisco, right, exhibited homosexual tendencies. So it could be that the people in that area had influence over the birds in that area. In any case, the
about the pigeons, Tel Aviv.
Right.
It doesn't happen yet, maybe.
So therefore the world became polluted spiritually. It wasn't destroyed because they were being punished. People were being destroyed because they were being punished, because they made choices of making themselves evil. But their evil affected and corrupted the world around them. And therefore, when you have spiritual pollution, how do you get rid of it? Go to a mikveh. So God immersed the world in a mikveh called the flood. And that's why the flood was 40 days and 40 nights, because the amount of water in a mikveh is 40 saw. The number 40 is significant. So 40 days and 40 nights of the flood was like putting the world in a mikveh, which explains something else too. The fish weren't destroyed. Now why? The fish were big tzaddikim? Because the fish were in a mikveh to begin with and were impervious to the pollution, to the corruption of human beings. They were separated from human beings. Yeah?
Yeah.
No, the water was boiling to also to get rid of... the fish, why the fish? So they say, right, they say that the water was only boiling on the top layers of the water. Underneath, the fish could go deeper and they survived.
Right.
That's why fish, in general, you don't have to shech them. There's no part of the fish that you can't eat, like blood and fish blood is mutter to eat. You can't just put it in a cup and drink it because it's marasai and looks like other blood. But you can eat the fish with its blood, with its chalev. There's no parts of the fish you can't eat. Fish grow in water. Water is tahar. The fish are totally tahar. There are non-kosher fish. Right. But the kosher fish, all of them are okay.
I'm just thinking. Our first question was, how can the bottom of the ocean be colder than the top? And then it occurred to me, it's the water
heats
the top.
Right, the warm air and water rise to the surface. They're lighter than the denser cold air and cold water. Okay, in any case, let's finish this idea up. So now, God said like this. The whole flood was necessitated because of people's tremendous power of influence over creation. So God said, they used it for the wrong, I'm going to change it. I'm going to reduce my influence over human beings in a less intense way, and therefore their influence over creation is to be less intense. So now, people may reach the level where they deserve to be destroyed. And they will be, like Sodom was destroyed. But they'll never have that kind of influence on the world that will necessitate the world to be destroyed. And therefore, that is one of the ways that the rainbow is a symbol of that. What's the simple idea of the rainbow? Why is the rainbow a symbol that God made an oath that even if the world would reach a level where it would have been destroyed like the first time, he's not going to destroy it? How does the rainbow show that? So some say one way the rainbow shows it is that there could be a rainbow in the clouds. When there's a flood that could destroy the world, the clouds are so dense that no light can penetrate them. The way that rainbow is formed is the sunlight goes through the clouds and the raindrops form a prism. And that's the rainbow. But that only works if the sunlight can go through the clouds. But if the clouds are so dense that the sunlight can't go through, there can't be a rainbow. So the fact there's a rainbow shows the clouds are not that dense and they're not going to create a flood. That's one way of the rainbow, yeah?
I was under the impression that the promise that Hashem made to the Olam was that he wouldn't destroy the earth with a
mob. It says, as a medrash, it says the following, that when the Torah was given, so there was lightning and thunder, and the nations of the world came to Bilam, and they wanted to know what's going on. So they said, we're afraid that God is bringing another flood. Bilam said, don't worry, what's it called? God promised you're not going to bring a flood. He said, yeah, he's promised not a flood of water, but maybe he's bringing you a flood of fire. It's going to be a atomic, you know, destruction of the world. So Bilaam said, no, no flood at all, not water, not fire. So it wasn't just a flood of water. Any kind of total destruction of the world was part of that. So that's one way that the rainbow represents that. The fact that it could be a rainbow shows the clouds are not as dense that could produce a flood. Another way is more simple. The rainbow represents a bow and arrow. And it's cocked, ready to shoot. There's only one problem, two problems. There's no string. So you can have a cocked bow, but if there's no string, you can't shoot anything from it. Another problem, there's no arrows. Even if there would be a string, it's a bow, but no arrows. And even if it would have a string and have arrows, it's facing the wrong way. If you put an arrow and a string, the arrow would go up, not down, the way the rainbow is. So it's a symbol that we may have all the ingredients of having a world that deserves to be destroyed, but it's not going to happen because there's no string, no arrows, and it's going the wrong way. I have a different idea. And that's based on what I just told you, that the whole reason the world had to be destroyed is because the influence that God had on people, which then transferred to his influence on the world, was so intense that when people were corrupt, they corrupted the world along with them. God's oath was, I'm changing the way the world is. People still have free choice. They could still be as evil and deserve to be destroyed. But they're never going to be able to have the influence over the world to make the world destroyed. They can't corrupt the world anymore. Their influence is not as strong. What's a symbol? What's a rainbow? White light that's broken down into its components of the different wavelengths from ultraviolet to infrared. That's a symbol of the rainbow. Before the flood, God's influence was like that intense white light. Everything, all the wavelengths together. And that was transferred to people, to the world, for the good or for the bad. Now God said, my influence, which is like that intense white light, is not going to be gone directly. It's going to be broken down first into its components. Nobody's going to get all of the influence. Some get this wavelength, some this wavelength, and therefore people are not going to be able to influence the world for the bad, but also for the good, right, in such an intensity. It's going to be broken down into its components, and that's the symbol of the rainbow. Therefore, before the flood, the way that people had the positive influence over the world was externally. By doing mitzvahs, by doing good things, they affected the world in a positive way. Instead of corrupting it and polluting it, just the opposite. They elevated it, sanctified it. But now after the flood, they can't do that anymore. Yeah, but not to the same degree, where it's going to ever be so corrupt or polluted it has to be destroyed.
No, but for good.
For the good, yes, but not with the same intensity that was before the flood. Because once it was reduced for the bad, it has to be reduced equally for the good. So therefore, how do people then elevate the world? The answer is by eating meat. Because now you can elevate it internally. When you eat the meat, you're elevating the meat, which elevated the plants, which elevated the minerals. So by eating internally, you're doing the same thing that you could have done externally before the flood. Now is necessary to do it from internally, by raising things up. So that's one of the reasons why they were allowed to eat meat after the flood, because before the flood, they didn't have to eat the meat to elevate it. They elevated the animals externally by their deeds. Now that was diminished. So another way of raising it up was by eating and raising the mineral that was raised to the vegetable by going into the plant. The plants go into the animals and the animals go into human beings and are raised to that level. So it could be that's another reason why they were allowed to eat meat after the flood. Okay. Next. And that is why the shulchan, when used properly, is like a mizbeach. What does a mizbeach do? You take things on the altar, and the altar itself is mineral, and what's it called? It has energy, which is fire, and you put on the altar the animal and vegetable. There's menachos, right? Flour, meal offerings that go on the Mizbeach, and birds that go on the Mizbeach, and animals that go on the Mizbeach. So the Mizbeach elevates the entire world. The mineral, vegetable, animal, and people are the ones that bring it and elevate it. So a table where you do the same thing, and you elevate the mineral, vegetable, animal, right? And especially the table itself is vegetable, it's wood, or metal, or whatever. And you, what's it called, eat at that table and elevate things. It's just like a mizbeach. So that's why the shulchan and the mizbeach are considered, what's it called, similar. And therefore, when you eat and you say divrei Torah and you combine the physical and the spiritual, you elevate everything. But if you don't say divrei Torah, then the eating is just a physical thing. So therefore, the physical part of the eating, right, creates waste. So basically, you're eating the way you're eating, like you're just creating waste. That's all. Kitzoa, right? So eating where there's no spiritual benefit to it is just an animalistic, very materialistic thing, and basically what's left of it is all the waste. When you elevate everything, so then it's not pollution, it's not contamination, just the opposite. It's becoming elevated and sanctified. In fact, according to some, the reason the shulchan is like a mizbeach is because you invite poor people, right, and provide them with what's it called, with food. That's the kapara. Right. So that also adds a, whenever you add a spiritual dimension to your meal, it's the same thing. And that's also divrei Torah. Divrei Torah doesn't necessarily mean you say words of Torah, but you do things that are Torahic. Yeah.
If you don't have three men at a table, but you do have three women,
so the halacha is like this: women do not have to bench mezuzah; men have to. If you have three men, they can't bench separately; they must bench together.
And five.
So if you have men and women, then and there's not enough men, no, there's no zimun. If there's only women, then three women together can make a mezuzah. And there, if they have 10 women, they don't say a different mezuzah. Mm. But any three or more, women can be mezuzah. There's nothing wrong with doing that. Mm. I used to have a shiur for women on my moshav. We learn once a week some sefer in Nach. And when we finished the sefer, so we went out to off the square. You can see how many years ago that was. And had a siyum. And I was the only man. And the women were the shear. And when it came to bench, I left. I benched, I left. And they were left, and they benched mezuzah. But the problem is that if you do it because the halacha is a woman is allowed to bench mezuzah, and if she wants to, there's no problem, as long as it's not men and women together. But if it's only women, women can bench mezuzah. But if you're doing it because of feminism, because you want to be, you have to be equal to men, and if they can bench mezuzah, I want to bench mezuzah, that's treif. So it could be for that reason today, it's really not done. I had girls by me from seminary girls that I teach for a meal on Shabbos, and I asked them curiously, they all eat together, do they ever bench b'mezuzah? And they don't. It's not... But the Mishabura says you can do it. I mean, halacha-wise, it's 100% okay. But the implication today would be, like, once they asked me years ago, can women dance with a Sefer Torah on Simchas Torah? So I told them, look, halacha-wise, there's no reason why not. However, if you're doing it because you love the Torah and you want, it's one thing. If you're doing it because you want to make a statement that we want to be like men, then it's treif. Then it's not covered for the Torah. So if you want to have something covered for the Torah, right, instead of dancing with it or whatever, have enough covered for the Torah that you don't want to give people who will abuse it the reason to learn from you to abuse the Torah in other areas. And that's today. Everything has to be equal. That's equal doesn't mean people do the same thing. Equal means that people do their role, right, and contribute it towards the common good. Right? Not everybody has to do the same thing. Yes?
I have a question along the lines of what you just said. I've always wondered, like, say there's a Muslim and a man, and I have to run off and say, like, that. Should I be part of that mezumen?
Yes, women who are eating together with men a mezumen are chayiv to be part of that mezumen.
You should answer.
Right, you should answer. Women really don't know that, but you can't just pick up and leave. You're part of the mezumen of the men.
Okay, thank you.
Right, you don't make up the mezumen, but if there is a mezumen of men, the women are part of that. They are required to be part of that. Okay. Okay, everything is like that. They have britot, right? They have to be equal. So they have, no, for girls, the eighth day by a girl, what do? Right? Not like the Muslims. What they do is they have, what's a mitzvah for a woman? A mikvah. So what they have is whole thing with a whole psukim or whatever, and they have a symbolic tvila, which is very similar to a baptism. Okay, but it's for a different reason, different religion, probably. And it's only to be, even with birth, right? I always tell my seminary students, if you think it's unfair that you don't have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, put on tefillin every day, so first of all, there's a lot of men who would like to change places with you. But if you think that's not fair, but you can do something about it. You can put on tefillin. Go down with a minion, right? But there's things in this world that if you believe God created the world, he did something very unfair. I said, when I got married, right, I wanted to be fair. So I told my wife, look, you get pregnant half the time, I'll get pregnant half the time. Fair. And never worked out. We have 11 children, can I know her? She got pregnant 10 times because we have twins, right? And I never got pregnant. It's really not fair. But who are you going to blame? The Rebbeim who made the world like that. Right, so the man thinks to make up a Dvar Torah for the bris or for the kiddush, right? And the woman has to go through 9 months of discomfort and the pain of leida. Is that fair? No, but that's the way the Rebbeim Shem made the world. You have complaints. You have to either you don't believe that God did it, and it's just an accident, or but in my sense, that's the Metzias, right? But today, in order to avoid that, what do they have? Lamaz, right? Where the husbands go and they learn to breathe deeply together with their wives while they're going through. So again, if it makes a woman feel good, right, she feels that, fine, no problem with that. But if you're doing it because this way the husband feels that it's an equality, we're doing this together, it's absurd. I'm sure my wife would have rather breathe deeply 1,000 times than go through the pain of a pregnancy and a birth. So a husband that fools himself into thinking, now it's equal, we're doing this together, is absurd. But that's the way the world is. It's crazy. Mama's crazy. So in any case, so that is, how do we get onto this? Oh yeah, with mezumen. So if you're doing it because the halach is you're allowed to make a mezumen, right? There's no problem. You're doing it because you want to dance with a Sefer Torah. There's no problem with a woman holding a Sefer Torah at any time of the month. She can hold a Sefer Torah, no problem. But if you're doing it in order to say, we're equal, everybody equal means the same, right, then that's treif. That's treif. So to bench mezumen because you want to show that you're equal, maybe that's the reason today they don't do it, because it would give that impression and lead to other things which are not proper.
I just want to ask, it's not exactly on this topic, because we spoke about the novel. Just like, you know, the people were, you know, given, did their language, after Hashem said, I'm going to change their language, did their each one had a different language? Like, for example, French, this, I mean, not, it wasn't, but
right.
You know what I mean? Each one had a different...
Yes, some say that all of the languages are distortions of Hebrew.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, there were words that were real Hebrew words originally, which got lost in these languages. And therefore, the Torah says we did things in 70 languages because some of the words are only lost in those languages. Right. But originally, they were distortions of the original Hebrew. And then they developed, what's it called, a lot of these languages developed, well, like the scientists say, they did develop because of regions or whatever, and the people made up languages. But the original 70 languages, right, to the 70 nations, were distortions, right, were distortions of Hebrew, right, and therefore it's like different dialects, which people, you know, Hackney or whatever, or you see somebody from Texas or from the deep south, sometimes you can't understand, right, my grandchildren growing up in Glasgow. And so they have a Scottish accent, my little grandchildren. I don't understand a word they're saying.
I don't either. And, you know, I taught French in Beis Yaakov High School for a few years. They used to tell the girls the French word for chaos is tombeau.
Oh, well. So there are a lot of words like that are lost in the English words also. I have quite a few of them that I picked up, that those are mamish originally Hebrew words. Okay.
Thank you.